I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. He's more powerful than a locomotive and speedier than a bullet. Superman is iconic in American comics, and he doesn't look his 75 years. This hour, we'll take a look at the Man of Steel and how his legacy on the page and on screen has played out over the decades, from his on and off romance with Lois Lane to his supposed death in the 1990s. Brian McTavish joins us, along with a comic book blogger and the author of a new book about the last son of Krypton. Later in the hour, we'll get the newest installment of 90 Mile View. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Up in the sky, look!
It's a bird!
It's a plane! It's Superman!
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me? Who's got you?
I'm more than a bird. I'm more than a plane. I'm more than some pretty face beside a train. And it's not easy to be me.
I did get things out in the open, starting with, will you marry me?
No, I got things out in the open, starting with, you are Superman.
A little louder, I don't think they heard you in Gotham City.
I can't do this all on my own. No, I know I'm no Superman.
And welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. He's flown through history with his trademark red cape, captivating America with his exploits after his arrival from the planet Krypton. Through comic books, TV shows, and more than a few movies, Superman is still as popular today as he was when he debuted in the 1930s. Now, on the 75th anniversary of the Man of Steel's creation, we'll talk about his roots, how far he's come since his introduction in Action Comics number 1. Superman's birth from the imaginations of two teenage boys living in the Great Depression gave them and the rest of the country the hero they needed. Here to shine some light on Superman's past is Larry Tye. He's author of the book Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. He was last on this program talking about his book Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, a book about the great pitcher Satchel Paige. Later on the hour, we'll delve deeper into how Clark Kent has transformed over the years in print and film. But first, Larry Tye. Larry, welcome back. So nice to have you again.
Great to be back with you.
Tell us a little bit about the creators of Superman, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Who were they? Where were they from?
They were from not far from you. They were from Cleveland, Ohio, two kids who grew up in the 1920s and had lived in a neighborhood called Glenville that was 70% Jewish. And Jerry was a kid who every day when he would go out on the playground was taunted by the other boys. They would yell at him, "Seagull, seagull, birds of an eagle." Now, I have no idea what that means, but I do know that if you're a little boy in the playground and all the girls are watching the other boys taunt you, what you wish you could do is fly away. He couldn't do that, but what he could do is go to bed every night with a pencil and paper and dream up a hero that would let him fight back against the bullies. And that hero he called the Super-Man. And it was not a very good guy. It was a mean kind of hero, the kind that a young kid would invent to fight back as a bully against the bullies. And that was what Superman looked like for the first 4 or 5 years after Jerry dreamed him up. And then when Jerry turned 17, something very traumatic happened to him. His dad owned a used clothing store on a seedy side of Cleveland. And one day, three big guys came into the store. They tried on a suit, and they walked out with the suit without paying. Jerry's dad chased him out the door, and as soon as he reached the threshold to the door, Michael Siegel had a massive heart attack and essentially dropped dead. Hmm. So Jerry, the youngest of six kids of these Lithuanian Jewish immigrants, was suddenly bereft. His father, his hero, was gone. And not long after that, he went to bed again with his pencil and paper, and he transformed the character that he had imagined. Gone was the in front of Superman. Gone was the hyphen between super and man. And in their place was a character that when Jerry ran across the street that morning after having dreamed up the character at night and showed his buddy Joe Shuster, the first ever picture that we had of Superman was him swooping in to save a guy who was being robbed who looked a whole lot like Michael Siegel. So what we should think of Superman is not somebody dreaming up a character that would last 75 years and making $1 billion. We should think of a kid who was trying to replace his dad and was trying to fight back against bullies.
That is such a warm, sad, real story. What a great story.
And the story actually, I would like to say that I had invented that story. The story actually came from an unpublished 150-page memoir that I found in the course of my research that Jerry Siegel had written and then never shared with the world.
Is Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, are they still with us?
Unfortunately, they're not. Both of them died in the 1990s.
And do those early drawings still exist somewhere, Larry?
They exist only in replica, the earliest ones. And the anybody among your listeners who's lucky enough to find one of the earliest comic books, like the original June 1938, should put it in a vault and plan to retire and send their kids to school on it.
But the original drawings that Jerry put together apparently no longer exist.
They don't exist.
Huh. Do we know what happened to them?
We know that at one point, Jerry and Joe were so frustrated with not being able to sell it that they actually burned some of the drawings. And it took them 5 years to find publishers who would publish their first Superman story.
Tell us a little more about what the original Superman looked like and what superpowers he had coming right out of the gate there.
Sure. So what he looked like was the crude, almost stick-like drawings that a young boy like Joe Shuster would put together. They were incredibly, to me, authentic, passionate. They had this sense of just the kind of hero that kids would dream up in terms of words and pictures. And that, to me, is what made Superman stick in those early days and have let him celebrate this month his 75th birthday, because they were exactly the kind of hero that every kid would have dreamed up. I don't know about you, but I imagine that me and most of the people out there listening can imagine a kid who needs to believe that his schlumpy-looking exterior is not what people see when they look at him. Everybody wants to imagine that they have a Superman within themselves and that the girls or everybody else will see that if they look closely enough.
So Jerry Siegel came up with the ideas and Joe drew them?
Correct.
Yeah.
They sold them that first drawing of Superman, that first comic book of Superman, they sold to their publishers for the rights to Superman for that issue and for any other Superman that they would ever come up with in any medium for a grand total divided between the two of them of $130.
I was going to ask you about that. They really sold the rights for that much. I mean, what that would be worth today, I guess, is almost incalculable.
What it would be worth today in this new Man of Steel movie that's out today, if it makes anything less than $1 billion, Warner Brothers will consider it a failure. That the character just in one movie can make $1 billion. So what it'll be worth today is, like the MasterCard ad says, it's incalculable.
Did Jerry and Joe, how long did they live, and to what extent did they see their creation come to life? And I'm wondering what regrets they might have had about selling the rights to their creation for $130.
So the story has two sides to it. On the one hand, they sold it for $130. On the other hand, the salaries that they were making in those early years in today's terms, would amount to hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Salaries they were making for doing what?
For writing and drawing Superman for DC Comics.
I
that
see.
Was salaries that they were making. So they had no ownership rights, but they were making enough money to make them quite wealthy. They were famous, these two obscure kids from Cleveland, and most importantly, they had been so desperate to sell it that I think they would have paid the publishers $130. So, but every 10 years or so, Jerry and Joe would get angry. They would realize, and particularly Jerry, that they would realize that their character had taken off and that they weren't sharing in those royalties. They'd get angry, they would sue, they would lose, and they would raise their right hand and say, "We promise if you take us back, we'll never sue you again," and that would last about 10 more years.
So they obviously felt a lot of frustration over having given up their great creation here.
They did. And they looked at it as the original sin of comic books, that this was the kind of thing that publishers would do in those days. They would basically buy it as cheap as they could. They would exploit the character to make him as popular as they could in as many medium as they could. And in the case of Superman, it started out with comic books. It spread to comic strips and hundreds of newspapers. He was one of the earliest and most successful figures in animation, the early cartoons, where he was nominated for an Oscar. He was the most successful kids' radio show of the 1940s. In the 50s, he had a brilliant TV show starring George Reeves. In every medium, he was an automatic success, and his publishers, if not his originators, became rich.
And so Jerry and Joe must have taken some satisfaction in seeing this thing, to borrow the pun, take off the way it did.
They did. They, depending on what moment you caught them, they were either incredibly proud as the parents of the most successful superhero ever, or they were incredibly resentful that they were not as wealthy as they thought they ought to be. And in their latter years, they were at times quite poor and really struggling. And it was ironic, it was sad, and it was also a function of the way the economy worked then.
We're visiting with Larry Tye. He's the author of the book Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. And we're having this conversation on the 75th anniversary of the Man of Steel's creation. Tell us a little more about the process that Jerry and Joe went through, Larry, to actually get Superman published for that first time. And what is that comic book worth today by chance?
Sure. So I'll tell you, the first part in terms of the process they went through was they sent it out to every comic book company that they could think of, every publisher they could think of, and they got, without exception, rejections. And so that was a really traumatic process for them until they found two ex-pornographers, the Harry Donenfeld and Jack Liebowitz, who agreed in 1938 to publish it and discovered that they had gold on their hands. That was really tragic, but it was exciting to them to finally find a publisher who would do it. And remind me, the second half of the question was,
how much is that first comic book worth?
So if you have a mint condition June 1938 Superman comic book, it is worth somewhere over $1 million, maybe 1.2, I think, may have been the highest value. And a guy, there was just a Wire story out a week or so ago about a guy who was doing a renovation job and found, when he was taking down a wall, he found a pretty vintage condition 1938 Action Comics Superman, and he and his brother were arguing over whose it was. They ended up ripping the cover.
Oh, no.
And instead of being worth $1 million, it was worth, I think, $10,000 or $15,000.
Oh, no. Hey, how many copies of that first comic are available?
So there were a couple hundred thousand printed. Everywhere I go and talk about the book, somebody will come up to me and tell me that they had them in a shoebox somewhere and their mother threw it away. And if all those mothers hadn't thrown them away, they wouldn't be worth much of anything today. But given that there are so few, probably in the hundreds left in any good condition, that's why they're so valuable.
Well, Superman fans, Larry, are obviously, you know, very well versed in sort of all the bad guys that Superman faces. What kinds of villains did the creators originally write into the comic books? And I was struck that in just reading about all this, that the KKK was an early enemy here.
The KKK was on a radio show called Cross of the Fiery Clan. The guy who was producing the radio shows back then was a real pioneer in terms of taking on causes, and he decided the best way to take on the Ku Klux Klan was to make fun of it, have the kids of America making fun of it. And so they actually broadcast secret Klan passwords, and legend has it that the Grand Dragon came home one day and heard his kids and all the kids in the neighborhood making fun of the Klan. That was he went looking for who the mole was and who passed on the passwords, but that was a brilliant way, I think, of taking on evil institutions at a time when most of America wasn't willing to stand up to them. Hmm. The earliest enemies, the enemy that Superman was taking on in every era was a perfect reflection of the enemy that America saw as the enemy in that era. So in the 1930s, the enemies were slumlords and wife beaters. This was the New Deal, and Superman was a butt-kicking liberal. In the 1940s, the enemies were Stalin and Hitler and the people that America saw as the enemy back in that time. In the 50s, it was the communists. In every era, Superman was a wonderful reflection of what America saw as its hero and as its bad guys, and that's one of the reasons why Superman has lasted through 75 years.
Well, were those enemies ever based on, you know, tough people or tough issues that Jerry and Joe were facing in their own lives at the time?
Yes, everything was based on what Jerry and Joe were facing in their own lives. So the idea of the hero in the first place, the notion that it was a hero that was hidden, that it had a mild exterior, was because Jerry and Joe had incredibly mild and nerdy-looking exteriors. And the enemies that they saw as the enemies in their world around them, these, you know, they grew up in a poor part of a big city, and so slumlords were the people in their lives that were the bad guys, and they made them the bad guys in the comic books. It wasn't a kid's dream to convert a kid's hero into the country's hero, to convert a kid's bad guys into everybody's bad guy.
You know, Larry, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, but you do wonder why so many publishers rejected this idea of Superman when it became such an instant hit and has endured for as long as it's endured.
Yes, they were incredibly short-sighted, and I think that everybody, on the one hand, it seems so natural to us, and yet when you look at the character, you can see why people might have said no. Who would believe that the character in those early days couldn't fly, but he was jumping really high, he could lift enormous boulders, he came from another planet. All of this seemed so outlandish, along with the fact that he wore his underpants over his tights. And they, I mean, the look of him, all the things we take for granted today were the ultimate fantasy, and I think that fantasy was brilliant, but again, I have the 20/20 hindsight you're talking about.
Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here if you want to chime in on our conversation with Larry Tye about Superman. Up to date at kcur.org is our email address. You can also tweet us at kcur up to date. Did the phrase truth, justice, and the American way originate with Jerry and Joe, or, you know, did that come along later on?
It came along fairly early in the process, and I don't think it was Jerry and Joe who came up with it. I think that it was the editors, but it was in the earliest days, just truth and justice, and that was what Superman stood for. The American way came along at the start of World War II, when the publishers were smart enough to realize that as our troops were going overseas and as Superman became associated with the battle for freedom, that they had to come up with just the right phrase. They hired a child psychologist who said that the American way was a way to capture all the things that we were fighting for in World War II, and that became part of the motto. So it was truth, justice, and the American way.
Hmm. Again, Larry Tye is our guest. His new book, Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. How did their Jewish faith influence who Superman was, both Jerry and Joe's?
It influenced it hugely. They grew up in a neighborhood, this Glenville neighborhood of Cleveland, that was 70% Jewish. When they looked around them, they could see a dozen synagogues. They could see one drugstore called Goldberger's. Their entire world was Jewish. And so they gave us hints that their hero was Jewish as well. Those hints were things like calling him The name that he left Krypton with was Kal-El, which any listeners who speak Hebrew will realize means the voice or vessel of God. He came down, think of this backstory, that parents are trying to save their firstborn son. So they float him out, let's say, into outer space. He ends up in the American heartland in the Midwest, adopted by two of the most consummate Gentiles that you will ever meet, named John and Martha Kent. They raise their baby as their own and suddenly realize that they've got a really exceptional kid on their hands. And if that's not the story of Moses or Exodus, then I don't know what is. But my favorite piece of evidence is that any name, there's a rule of thumb that any name that ends in the word M-A-N is one of two things. It is either a superhero or a Jew, or in this case, both. So when listeners see the word S-U-P-E-R-M-A-N, they should know it is not pronounced Superman, it is Superman.
Oh, that's interesting. If you can tell us how important Superman was to you when you were a kid, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address is update@kcur.org. I'm just wondering, what do you think Jerry and Joe would think of the way Superman has evolved over the years into what he is today, Larry?
Well, that's a really timely question because today is the opening
of the
Man of Steel movie.
Have you seen it?
And I think they'd... I have not, but I'm actually, when I hang up this phone, I'm on my way to a movie theater to see it.
Ah.
And everything that I've been reading about the movie, and I was last weekend with the creative director for DC Comics, who was intimately involved with the movie, suggests that lots of things remain very true to what Jerry and Joe's creation story, the whole notion of this hero being out to save the world. There are little bits and pieces that I think that they would take exception to. They would take exception to the fact that he's no longer wearing his underpants on the outside. He's got a clean-cut uniform. They would take exception to the fact that he was an explicitly Christian character in this movie to the point where in one scene he's shown next to a picture of Jesus Christ. And they might take exception to the fact that for the last half an hour of the movie, it's all about a battle scene, and that the sort of the real story, the wonderful creation story, which takes up the first 90 minutes of the movie, is a bit in a fade-out mode in the end where it's just all about a battle. And I think Jerry and Joe, even though they were kids who loved battles, understood that the real story was a human story and not a story just about people fighting.
We'll talk more about the movie in our second half today. Brian McTavish will be with us, and the movie's not getting the best reviews, at least the ones I've read so far here. Al from Overland Park. Al, good morning. You're on with Larry Tighe. Good morning.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, Al.
75 years ago, when Superman came out, I was 6 years old.
Wow.
And I was about to become a voracious reader, and I had not only the first issue, but stacks of issues that I saved. I had probably several stacks, maybe 10 to 12 inches high. I saved every issue of Superman, and you can only imagine what those might all be worth.
Oh, boy.
I also saved Captain Marvel and Batman and several others, but I was one of those early readers.
As popular as they could in as many medium.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, Al, what happened to those old comic books that you had? Do you know?
You're asking me to remember what happened 75 years ago. They probably got pitched somewhere along the line.
Right.
I used to go through them maybe once a month or so and stack them in order of those that were my favorite.
Yes.
And the ones that weren't so favorite got pitched, and it was a rotating stack, so no telling where they are now. They're probably in a landfill.
Al, thank you for the call. And Larry, I bet you've heard that story a few times.
I have, and I'm really jealous of Al to have been around at the creation. And I think the more kids like Al learned how to read through the comic books. They were the perfect way to read. No words were more than two syllables. There were pictures explaining what you were reading. And that's how we trained lots of illiterate soldiers during World War II, learned how to read through these Superman comic books.
Yeah. Let's go to Jesse from Leavenworth. Jesse, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Jesse.
I'm here. I'm sorry. I'm looking for the phone. My question was Captain Marvel and Captain Marvel Jr., I guess, were knockoffs of Superman. And by the way, I wasn't born until the month after the comics first came out.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember Superman very well, but I also remember Captain Marvel and Captain Marvel Jr. Where did they come from?
Were those knockoffs of Superman, Larry?
Yes. So what happened was Captain Marvel was a clear knockoff on Superman. DC Comics took the publishers of Captain Marvel to court. They basically got him taken up off the shelves. And decades later, DC bought the rights to Captain Marvel. The irony is that while Superman knocked Captain Marvel off the shelves, Jerry admits in his memoir that he stole the Superman idea from everybody from Samson and Hercules to all the comic books and the pop culture characters of the time. And everybody was stealing from everybody, and poor Captain Marvel was the one who took the fall for it.
Well, what a marvelous story. Larry, I want to thank you for your time. Larry Tye, again, is the author of Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. Larry, thanks so much for your time. Always good to have you here.
Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye. Time for a break. When we come back, Brian McTavish joins us along with Aaron Weber to talk about Superman in the movies and more about Superman in the comics. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Well, as we mentioned in our first half, today is the Superman edition of Up to Date as we commemorate the 75th anniversary of the Man of Steel's creation. And, of course, there's yet another new Superman just hitting the theaters today. Joining us now to bring us up to speed on how far Superman has come since his creation are Aaron Weber, who's a film critic and runs the site Dad's Big Plan. Aaron, nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Brian McTavish is also here. He brings us his weekend to-do list each week, which he did yesterday. He's also a ferocious collector of comic books. Buddy, how are you?
You can't keep me out of here.
Can't keep you out of here, yeah. Well, Brian, as a comic book character, Superman has certainly changed since his first appearance back in 1938. Mm. Which iteration of the Man of Steel was the most popular among comic book readers?
Well, it's got to be the Golden Age Superman, the original
Which was
Superman.
The early one.
Action
yeah.
1, June 1938. The guy whose very first deed of heroic behavior was taking care of a wife beater.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is that what the first story was about?
Yeah. I think he also got involved in a penal colony that was out of control, and there was one other, it was a three-parter, I believe. But yeah, the first thing he does is he takes care of a guy who's beating up his wife, and he tosses him across the room or something like that, obviously holding back. He didn't want to kill the guy because Superman doesn't kill, or does he, Aaron?
Oh, I don't know if I'm ready to get into that yet.
We were just talking in the green room. Aaron has actually seen the new Superman movie.
We're going to talk about it in
all
just
right, we'll
a
get
few
to
minutes.
That.
Yeah.
Well, back to the comic, Golden Age Superman. It's the most valuable. It's the most iconic. It's the most basic wish fulfillment fantasy where here's a man flying, actually leaping tall buildings initially, but that's the one that collectors really go crazy for.
You know, Aaron, on the big screen, which versions of Superman sort of stuck as directors sort of worked to adapt him to the silver screen?
Well, you know, the two biggest, the original serials back in the late 40s had a big impact. And then you had the Max Fleischer cartoons that would run in front of the films. And that was a massive part of building the mythology in pop culture. But the George Reeves television series, The Adventures of Superman, really set the standard for what we think of as Superman. A lot of the language and the feeling of Superman comes from the George Reeves version of the character. But of course,
and that show started when? Back in the 50s?
That was I think 48.
Early 50s,
yeah. And then
and it was around for a long time.
It did. It ran for quite a while. And then there was a cartoon that no one likes to talk about that occurred about 15 years later, which was another The Adventures of Superman. But then we got Richard Donner's Superman in 1978, and that has pretty much erased everything else. Mm-hmm. And that's the iconic version of Superman and Clark Kent that everybody thinks of, even though there was a lot done with that character that hadn't been done before. George Reeves' version of Clark Kent wasn't some bumbling, clumsy oaf. He was a really self-assured, you know, he was mild-mannered. That's how they always described him. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't bumbling. He wasn't, you know, a fool. He was actually very clever. And it wasn't until, you know, Mario Puzo, writer of The Godfather, who wrote the script for the Donner film, you know, they added this kind of, not cornball element, but they wanted the screwball feel to offset the rest of the
There's such a funny story about George Reeves when he first took that role of the TV Superman, where I read somewhere that he turned to the woman who was playing Lois Lane when they first came on stage for the first time before the cameras, and off camera, he sort of said to her, you know, babe, this is the bottom of the barrel. We're absolutely, you know, in a terrible, terrible straits here. And I gather that that role was financially successful for him, too, I imagine, over the years.
And he was unable to get away from it.
He was typecast for the rest of his career.
So successful and so beloved was George Reeves as Superman. Probably his most famous television appearance as the Man of Steel was on an episode of I Love Lucy.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's huge. Because I Love Lucy was the number one and then some show on television. So little Ricky, right, Lucy and Ricky's son, right, for a birthday party, what does Lucy do? Well, she's going to bring Superman to the party, but it falls through. So she dresses up as Superman, and she's not doing very well. And through some kind of lucky machination, the real George Reeves shows up as Superman. Ricky made it happen, right? You know, Ricky always takes care of Lucy. So there's this crazy scene where George Reeves and Lucy gets out on the ledge of the apartment building, and George Reeves has to talk her in. It's a crazy episode, but everybody loved George Reeves as Superman. He was so darn likable. And, of course, George Reeves, up until that point, he wanted to be an A-lister. And as you suggested, he thought he was doomed to B and C status. But Superman, everlasting fame.
816-235-2888 is our phone number. UpToDate at KCUR.org is our email address. Doc from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Hey, enjoying the show.
Good.
Avid Superman collector. A couple pieces of trivia. Superman also was in a musical on Broadway. There was a book written for children. They commissioned a guy, George Lowther, in 40 or 41, about a 150-page book for children. And in that book, he said that the names of Superman's parents were Sarah and Eben Kent. And I would also highly recommend a couple books about the death, probable murder of George Reeves, called Hollywood Kryptonite and Speeding Bullet, which are both about the fact that he was probably murdered and did not commit suicide. And I'd like your guest to speak to the tie-in of the Superman name to Nietzsche's Ubermensch, the Ode to the Superman.
Ah, okay. Thank you, Doc. What about that?
Well, that's you know, as your previous guest pointed out, there's a lot about the history of Superman and the creation of that mythology came from, you know, kind of this Jewish wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
But the name Superman was chosen because it was the English translation of Übermensch, which, you know, Nietzsche's term for Superman.
Yeah.
Which, you know, as we look back on it and we think of what that character has become, it's almost kind of a sly appropriation of the term, because it's what we think of as Superman is so very different than what Nietzsche's had in mind for that term. But it was very much a conscious decision to do so.
And do we think that George Reeves was murdered, the man who played Superman on TV? Is that what the...
There's enough ambiguity about it that's the prevailing narrative, is that he was most likely murdered.
Because why?
Well, you know, he...
He seemed like such a nice guy.
Well, that, you know...
Right.
But, you know, it Hollywood at that time, you know, there's a lot of seedy elements at play, and it was really easy for especially somebody like George Reeves, who wanted to be an A-lister but was kind of stuck in this perpetual, I hate to say C-list, because he was so beloved, he was so iconic, but from his own perspective, it was, you know, he was kind of stuck in this rut. So it's easy to get sucked in by these bad elements. And
they made a movie about this whole mystery surrounding George Reeves. Who was the star?
Ben Affleck. The Hollywood Land.
And there was some suggestion, maybe, Aaron, maybe on the wrong, is this the right track, but wasn't the plot kind of suggested he might have been cheating with some big shot's wife?
Yeah, or that he was involved with a mobster's wife. Yeah,
right.
Never a good
idea. Or mistress,
idea.
Yeah. Yeah,
oh,
bad.
Yeah.
And just, but when you're Superman, I mean.
Well, why not?
I want to mention that the caller referenced to 1966 was the year that Broadway musical came out, and it was called It's a Bird, It's a Plane,
it's Superman.
Right.
Why not? Okay. Let's go to Larry from Independence. Larry, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Hi, fellas. I just wanted to kind of give you a cultural impact comment about this. I'm a boomer. We grew up in front of the television. Superman was one of the iconic shows. You've been talking about George Reeves. And what I remember very distinctly was, you know, the way they started that show was when they talked about truth, justice, and the American way.
Mm-hmm.
In a child's head, those three words became either an unhyphenated concept or synonymous with each other. I don't know how to put it any better than that.
Mm-hmm.
And it contributed a great deal, I think, to an idealism that we post-World War II children grew up with. And I think it contributed a lot to the way many of us behaved in the 60s in rejecting some of the hypocritical behaviors that we saw in our elders. Now, that's just my opinion. It's one element, but it was a contributing factor to an idealism that my generation shared until you reach an age when you see your parents for what they really are, kind of.
Yeah. Larry, thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Carl writes us this. Our dad took us to see the first Superman movie with Christopher Reeve on Christmas Day, 1979. I remember I was 12 and thought that, man, wouldn't that be cool to have someone like that around to help us out. My girls are now 9 and 6, and they each have Superman dolls and can't wait to go see the new movie. A couple of years ago, we went through Metropolis, Illinois, and toured the Superman Museum there and highly recommend it to any Superman fan. You guys been there?
I haven't, no.
No, yeah.
I haven't. I have a friend, a fellow comic book collecting fiend, who makes it every year. And just goes out there. They have a Superman costume contest. They have rules. You have to have a yellow belt. You have to have a red cape. No alternative Superman category yet, you know.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Brian, go back to the comic book sort of arc of Superman's life. And what are some of the big moments or turning points of his comic book career?
Sure. Well, it's a personal thing. Everybody, I mean, so many years, so many stories and adventures. You could just, you know, you could pick any. I'm going to pick a few that really mean a lot to me. Beginning in 1967, in issue 199 of Superman Comics, that was the first Superman Flash race. You know, the Flash, the fastest man alive.
I was going to just bring that up. I remember that race, and I was captivated by that storyline.
Hey, did you see that comic on the spinner rack in 1967? I sure did. I was blown away. Here's Superman and the Flash at the starting line, taking off as fast as they
can. I remember
that.
It's
black
so
background.
Funny.
Half the Justice League is rooting for Superman. Half the Justice League is rooting for the Flash. I lost that comic, but as an adult, I had to go back and buy myself a nice one some years ago.
What did that cost you?
12 cents.
Well, I mean then, but what are the new...
I'm a bottom feeder. I got a nicer one for 30 or 40 bucks. You know, no big deal.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway, so that was a three-part deal. They actually raced three times, mm-hmm. well, many times, but three mm-hmm. times during the Silver Age. First time was in that issue of Superman. The second time, a few months later, was in an issue of Flash. Now, both of those ended in ties because, not to go into too much detail, thank goodness, gambling was involved. There were side bets, right? So when Superman and the Flash figured out that people were gambling, well, hey, they're not going to let gamblers win. So they kind of tied at the end. The third one was in World's Finest Comics. It's such a convoluted plot. There were alien robot monsters and lots of crazy things happened. But technically, they lost their powers. And so at the very end, Superman and the Flash are crawling on their elbows and arms across a desert. And for one reason or another, technically, the Flash crosses the finish line first, but only so he can flip a lever and save the universe or something along those lines. A few more great stories. Well, of course, I believe, didn't you discuss the death of Superman earlier in the show?
Just briefly.
Real briefly. 1992, death of Superman. Nobody had any idea this was going to cause the sensation it did. Slow news day, media hype. They sold 3 million copies of Superman that day that it came out in 92, and a total of 6 million copies with reprints. Of course,
why did he die? What was the...
Go ahead. Go ahead.
So they actually killed him off because his sales had been lagging for ages, really, really badly. A few years prior, a few years prior, John Byrne, the great comic writer, had rebooted the series with Man of Steel, and they modernized Clark Kent. He wasn't a nerd in high school. He was the captain of the football team. He was, you know, he was an accomplished guy.
Yeah.
But that didn't resonate with anybody. The sales were lagging, so they kill him through what is basically a 6-issue fist fight with an otherworldly being.
Doomsday. That was the villain, yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I find it interesting that I was hoping you would bring up the Superman Muhammad Ali.
The giant-sized Treasury edition, wonderful book. Yeah, I mean, as big as a Life magazine, Superman. And if you want, like, that could be the most highly sought-after piece of old paper that I know of, Superman versus Muhammad Ali.
Yeah,
people love that. They actually reprinted it in a smaller but more keepsake edition hardcover in the last year or two. But who really wants that? You want to get the old one in perfect condition in somebody's garage. It's been sitting there for 40 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, Death of Superman, he was resurrected through some mumbo-jumbo science fiction meets Christ our Savior kind of a thing. They actually stole his body out from his tomb, if you will. He was somewhere in a morgue.
Really?
And all this crazy stuff goes on for a year or two. There was also a Reign of Superman storyline.
Yeah, they introduced four new characters that were kind of not pretenders to the throne, but you know, taking up the mantle.
There was a cyborg Superman, somebody named the Metropolis Kid, the last son of Krypton, and an African-American version called Steel. And they had different things going on. But eventually Superman comes back because you can't kill Superman.
Well, Aaron, how is the new movie?
Or can you?
I mean, I know you're
this way. Zack Snyder tries.
Yeah.
I love the character. I love the ideal. I love the mythology behind it. And I'm not a big fan of the director, Zack Snyder, and I wasn't a huge fan of Nolan's Batman films, as blasphemous as that is in the comic book community.
Yeah.
But I had high expectations for this film. And if you just like spectacle and big budgets and explosions and fights, a lot of people are going to enjoy it. But as a Superman film, it leaves a lot to be desired. They talk a lot in the trailers about, you know, your S symbol on the costume is a symbol of hope.
Yeah.
This movie has not an ounce of hope nor joy.
Aaron,
that's what the stars, reviewer today, David Freese wrote that today.
Yeah. The trailers were magnificent. The coming attractions were superb. So it would seem that the old saw is correct, that the better the preview, the worse the movie?
Pretty much, yeah.
It's a shame.
It is a shame.
But I still got to go. I mean, as soon as I get out of here, I'm going to take my son and I'm going to go see this.
You're going.
I'm going to call the girlfriend, see if her son wants to go. Let's all go. Because, you know, it's like you got to play the game, right? I mean, by that I mean, will it be good or bad? I have to see it with my own eyes.
And he's still, just briefly, gentlemen, he's still big today. Superman is still big today. Why? Well, you would think we would have moved past it, but here we are talking about a new movie debuting today.
Well, you know, the mythology there is timeless. And that's the thing about the kind of the pantheon of comic book heroes that have lasted over the years. It's less about the character themselves and the ideals they represent. That's basically our modern mythology.
Yeah.
Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, you know, the X-Men. It's a mythology that we can absorb in the modern day. And we like those types of stories.
Yeah. He's the ultimate unambiguous good guy. And just very briefly, if you want to see the flip side of that, in recent years, a graphic novel worth searching out, excellent story, it's called Red Sun. It's the story of what would have happened if that Kryptonian spaceship bearing the baby Superman had landed in Russia instead of the USA. So Superman grows up to be a Marxist and a communist, and guess who's running the USA? Who's the good guy? Lex Luthor, his arch enemy.
Wow.
It's a great story. Kind of just shows you how time and place means everything.
Brian McTavish, always good to have you here. Aaron Weber, a film critic, runs the site Dad's Big Plan. Thank you for your time today, too.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.